Now please join me in prayer. Amen. I've been thinking all week about this old saying, or variation on the old saying, extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures. I've been thinking about it all week because we keep hearing about, well, this is so extraordinary. This has never been done this way before. These people are saying they're going to blow up the filibuster rule that's been in place for generations because an extraordinary move. But because these other people are going to try to filibuster a qualified judge. An extraordinary move. But they're doing it because the first people blocked their qualified judge. An extraordinary move based on the fact that the second people changed the rules last time around when they had the chance to. But they only did that extraordinary move because of the prior extraordinary use of obstructionistic tactics. This cycle of extraordinary responses that you can see going back all the way almost to the dawn of time. I've been thinking about this extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures. And I've been thinking about it because I've been seeing in my friends on the Facebook and in the social media and the way preachers secretly talk to each other, the back channels we have, how many preachers are feeling called to preach extraordinary sermons in response to extraordinary times. I've been thinking about how much I've been talking about public events. I think the life of faith has to be about both public events and personal heart growth, spiritual life, the political and the existential. And I've worried that I and a lot of my friends are worrying the same thing. Have we been talking too much about the public sphere and not enough about the sphere of the heart? Obviously, it's not that they don't have anything to do with each other, but the focuses can change. Last week, I tried to talk about what makes life blessed. I have to say, I don't think I did a very good job of it because I was being distracted, even in my own preparation, by all this extraordinary stuff going on. Or I heard a story from my sister and her family. Their preacher at their church last Sunday preached in response to these immigration orders that had come down just the night before. And she preached a sermon that was extraordinarily long and extraordinarily angry. And I don't know that I would have disagreed with anything she said, but their people in the church were angry about this. And they were wondering, did she have the right to preach such an extraordinary sermon? And her response, I'm sure, was, these are extraordinary times. And I've been thinking about it this week, too, because of the lesson that the lectionary suggests to us for today. You know the first part so well, salt and light. We'll get to that. But this week I was especially struck by the second part. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you that until the end of the age, not one letter, not one little mark on the letter, not one dot on an I, not one comma will be taken away until all of the law is accomplished. As you can imagine, I don't often preach that part of this lesson. I'm not a big law and order guy. I worry about if we're too slavish to tradition, I worry that we're not leaving enough room for us to innovate, for us to create, for us to do something new in response to God's new call in our lives. So I don't always talk about the part about Jesus saying, I have not come to abolish anything. So this week I've been wrestling with here whether maybe he's got a point. Maybe if we can't keep to the ordinary ways, the established ways will never break the cycle of extraordinary measures. I want to be very careful. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be innovative, that we shouldn't be tactical, that we shouldn't be strategic. I'm not saying that we should unilaterally disarm, following the old rules when other people won't follow them. I'm not saying we should be good citizens in a way that makes us suckers. But I do want to talk about hewing to the old ways at a deeper level, because the basic rules have not changed. What does God demand of us? What does God require of us? The answer to that question was written down 2,500 years ago, and we've read it ever since. Do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with God. What is the greatest commandment? The answer to that question was written down 2,000 years ago, long before the Electoral College, long before the Constitution, long before polling and strategery. Not electoral victory, not the next election. The greatest commandment is to love the Lord our God with all our heart and mind and soul and strength, to love our neighbors as ourselves. There's nothing extraordinary about that, nothing new in that. That we need to root ourselves in these ordinary teachings that we've been given from time immemorial. That should guide our tactics and our strategies, not winning for the sake of winning, but the love of God and the love of neighbor. That's how we know we shouldn't make fun of the children of political office holders or shame their spouses. That's how we know that we're not fighting against enemies of the flesh. That was written down 2,000 years ago. Our enemies are not enemies of the flesh, but the powers and the principalities of the forces of selfishness and of empire, the sky gods of taking and owning and of subjugating. That's the enemy. We're not called to oppose any particular politician. We're called to care about our fellow citizens and the policies and the ways of helping them and building each other up. We're called to care about the vulnerable people of this nation, the vulnerable people of this world. We need to stay focused on that very ordinary fact. Because as a great and powerful nation that loves to do extraordinary things, we have great power to help or to hurt our citizens, all the citizens of the world. We're called to care about the thriving of God's creation. That's the final end that we have to keep front and center. And keeping these things front and center is what matters. It's what gets us out of despair or hopelessness. It's what gets us out of frustration back to the basic call of love. It's what gets us out of, you know, this emotion that they call Schadenfreude, right? Anytime someone I disagree with does something that makes them look stupid or ridiculous or out of touch, there's a part of me that laughs, that takes some gratification out of that. But that can't be where I stop. That can't be where I stay for very long at all, because I have to love the world that this is happening in and love the people that these policies will or won't help. That's what really matters, not my emotional gratification, but love. There's so much outrage. There's a much more legitimate response than Schadenfreude. Outrageous things demand outrage, but we can't stay stuck in outrage. We have to get back to love. Outrage as an expression of love, and not merely an expression of being committed to our team winning and their team broke the rules. I've been thinking about this week, because Wednesday night I went to a recital at Symphony Hall. Not a march, not a protest, a recital. This violinist by the name of Guidon Kremer was playing with his little chamber orchestra. Now, Guidon Kremer is just as good, just as fancy, just as technically adept as any of them. And he could have had that career where you get paid millions of dollars every year for showing up and playing the Beethoven concerto, the Brahms concerto, the Tchaikovsky concerto over and over and over again. But he didn't want to do that. He wanted to build a career championing new music, 20th century music, music that was written in response not to the Napoleonic Wars, but to World War II, written in response not to the Habsburg Empire, but in response to the Stalin Empire, music that was written in response not to the 30 Years' War, but to the Vietnam War. Music that was trying to answer the question, what is the sound of the voice of God and of God's glorious love in the world now? Same question they always asked. But now when trumpet fanfares and angel choirs no longer seem to quite do the trick, what is the voice of the sound of God now? The end of the concert, there was this second to last piece, was this very big, very robust, flamboyant piece of musical fanfare and chimes and timpanis and orchestral full volume. But instead of just stopping and getting the standing ovation they'd earned, they quieted way down, and Guidon Kremer, this violinist, stood up, and the lights all dimmed except for the spotlight on him, and he played this very new sounding, very atonal, very weird, poignantly beautiful piece of music that was written just a few years ago. And you could have heard a pin drop in the place. It had the sound of the old lesson speaking anew. And as he wound down this soft, quiet piece of music, I realize I'm crying, sitting in my seat. I'm crying because in this moment, he had opened up a space that I had forgotten about. A space in the anger, a space in the clamor, a space in the extraordinary outrage and the joy in other people's stupidity, a space for the humane, for where I could remember what it was like to be a child of God underneath all of that crust and all of that outside stuff. And I realized how hungry I had been for that. Not as a diversion, not as an avoidance, but to remember what was always most important, that it's still most important, to rediscover that old call, that old voice. Not an avoidance, not a distraction, but a remembering what it means to live. There's a part of me I want to say, I don't want our poets going to rallies if it means they're not writing the poems that are going to call us back to our true selves. I want them to give their gifts. Of course, it's a false choice. You can go to rallies and write poems. You can respond on that more surface level to the strategic, tactical needs of the day, but always listening back to that original music. That ordinary background human love, noise, sound of God in creation. These are extraordinary times, and in some ways extraordinarily inhumane times. But the only response is our ordinary loving humanity as children of God. In times of disdain and cruelty and harshness and callous disregard, we have to make time and space for our humanity as children of a loving God. the same ordinary work we always have. Because it's still true what was true back then, that you are the salt of the earth. And if salt has lost its taste, how can it be restored? And you're no longer good for anything. If we lose that original savor, we're no longer good for anything but to be thrown out, to be trampled underfoot. We are the light of the world, he says. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. No one lights a lamp and puts it under a bushel. Put it on the lampstand so the whole house can be lit. We are the salt of the earth, and if all we have to offer is scorn and derision, then we've lost our savor and we're good for nothing. We are the light of the world, but if we only shine with the dim light of outrage, then we're putting our lamp under a bushel. So what if this time is extraordinarily different from what's gone before? An extraordinary time requiring extraordinary measures, tactics, strategies, creative new answers to the problem of American citizenship. Well, we should take those measures. We should reason out those things. But because deeper, we're no different at all. Because we are acting the way ordinary Christians, if they were true to the name, have always acted in times of danger, in times of oppression. We're acting the same way we always had, as children of a loving God. We are created and commissioned in the same ordinary way we've always been, to be emissaries of God's love, to love justice, to love mercy, to love God with all our hearts and minds and souls and strength, to love our neighbors as ourselves. And may that be our constant and ordinary response to everything that comes. Amen.